This is Kate Moorhead Carroll in the podcast, Find It. Today I have with me Professor Julie Ingersoll, an American religion professor from the University of North Florida. Welcome, Julie. You have spent 30 years studying American religions. Let's start off by asking, how did this come to fascinate you so that you would devote 30 years of your life to it? What brought you to the study of American religion?
I really love politics, and I was a political science major in college. And you can tell by my age, that was like the mid-80s, early 80s. And so it was the rise of the religious right. And I got very interested in how they were building that and ended up minoring religion at that point. And so it goes way back to college.
Wow.
A gen ed course I took. Advertisement for general education.
Yes, good education produces good scholars like yourself. So tell us from the beginning, when did this movement called Christian nationalism begin? What do you see as the seeds that were planted, and when did that happen?
I'm really glad you started there, because one of the things that has happened is this movement has been around for a really long time, and we consistently change the name of it. So it was the Christian Right, and then we had a new Christian Right, so we had to change the name to the other one, to the old Christian Right, and then there's a moral majority and the Tea Party, and there have been other things in between. And what happens, and now we're Christian nationalism, but what happens when we do that is we lose the important historical trajectory and the important point that these folks have been at this a really, really long time. They are post-millennialist. They think that the kingdom of God is now, and it's their job to build it, and it might take 1,000 years. So they are not thinking about the midterms necessarily only. They're thinking really long-term, a couple hundred years at least, and that makes a big difference in how we might engage them, right? They're not concerned about the here and now necessarily.
So they have a long-range plan, you
Very
could
long
say.
Range.
And when did they begin all the this thread that goes through so many years?
It can really go back to the fight over communism.
Okay.
But the movement I study really started in the late 1950s, and the founder was R.J. Rushdoony. They were kind of Calvinist Presbyterian.
Rushdoony.
R.J. Rushdoony.
Okay.
And this is an obscure group. They never got big. They're not big today, but they've always outsized their numbers with their influence. And part of the reason was that they built the Christian school movement. And on that was built the Christian homeschool movement. And so they were able to influence people in their thinking with their ideas far more broadly than they actually had in anybody that might be called a member.
So one of the things about this movement that started in the 50s is they educated people. What would you have called that movement when it began?
They called themselves Christian Reconstructionists, and
Christian Reconstructionists.
What I would call them. The iteration of it today is the church movement out in Moscow, Idaho, with which Pete Hegseth is affiliated.
I see.
They've come a long way.
And tell me about, so the theology has been pretty consistent since the 1950s?
Yes, yeah.
What would you describe as some of the essential pieces of this unique theology?
Well, I think the first thing to note, as our conversation at the table started, they understand Jesus completely differently. They use the Old Testament and the New Testament. They see it as a continuing revelation, and they don't see the characteristics of Jesus in the New Testament as somehow replacing a different kind of deity in the Old Testament, like lots of modern Christians do. This is called the unity of Scripture. So when we talk about what would Jesus do, their idea about what Jesus would do is based in Genesis, Deuteronomy, like they trace the Trinity all the way back to those eras. And so everything looks really quite different for them.
So you would say that they see Jesus acting more like the Old Testament God that we see in the Hebrew Scriptures?
Well, they see Jesus as part of the Trinity. And that the Trinity has been forever. So Jesus was present at creation.
Well, we believe that too. But in terms of his behavior, they think of Jesus as more wrathful or more angry. Is that what you're saying?
They think of those as also characteristics of God. So yes, I mean, God is also one, right? It's three and one. Uh-huh. So the characteristics of God include the kinds of things that you read in the Sermon on the Mount, for example, but also the characteristics of God that are described in the book of Revelation and the book of Deuteronomy.
I see. So instead of thinking that Jesus came to teach us about love and change our understanding of God, mm-hmm. they think that God of the Hebrew Scriptures mm-hmm. and Jesus didn't change the message. Mm-mm. So it's a Hebrew Scriptures nope. type of a message.
Gotcha. What is that? That Jesus the same today, tomorrow, whatever? It's Hebrews, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be a central kind of thing that they would hold on to. Mm-hmm.
I almost want to get in a theological debate about that point, but okay.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
just
because
to be clear.
Why would the incarnation of God come if not to show us more about God? But they think it was just the same message from...
It wasn't about a message. It was about a sacrifice for them. But to be clear, my training's in history and sociology. I don't hold this view.
No, I know you don't.
So you could debate it with them, but okay. not with me necessarily.
Well, one day I'll get some of them up
describe.
Here.
I just describe.
So tell us, they begin in the 50s, and tell us how the movement moves sociologically and politically, because that's your specialty. How does it start influencing and growing within this country?
Well, their plan is based in dominion theology. That also goes back to Genesis. And they believe it's their job to make the whole world Christian. So they not only think this is a Christian or should be a Christian nation, they think all nations should be Christian nations. And so to build that, they established Christian schools. And it happened to be at the same time as Brown v. Board of the Education. And so people who wanted to take their kids out of integrating public schools often put them in Christian schools. And it was convenient because all they had to say was, they didn't have to say, I don't want my kids going to school with black kids. They could just say, but the Bible says. And this was really important, I think. It was just the historical timing that threw them into a place where the thing that they were doing met the needs of certain people at the time. But they've been engaged in politics since then. They were active during the Reagan administration. In the kind of Washington, well, we would now call it Christian nationalism, but then we called it the new Christian right. And they focus very much on the granular level. So they've argued, I wrote something about them in the 1980s trying to take over school boards, for example. So they see themselves with a long-term strategy of advancing their understanding of Christianity in all areas of life.
Do they think that Christianity is only with white people? Or is how does that work for them?
That's just such a great question, right? Because, at least from my point of view, religion doesn't exist outside of history and culture. Every version of religion exists in a particular context, and it has its own things that make it what it is. They don't understand it that way, and so they universalize what they think is a general, broad, universal Christianity, which is really a white American Christianity. It isn't even if you take out the race part, it's not even European Christianity, right? They don't see the cultural context of what they think, so they don't think they're promoting white Christianity over against something else. They think that they're putting the universal Christianity.
So their Christianity is the real one that should be all over the world.
Exactly.
Whatever they think is the way that it should be. Okay. Mm-hmm. So why did it start in the 1950s? What was the fertile environment to birth that kind of way of thinking?
Well, many of the early writers and leaders were members of the Birch Society. They drew on Old South Presbyterianism, so there's never, like, everything evolves from other things, right? So I think it was the transformation in culture, and you have, when there's chaos or drastic change, people look for different explanations, and people often find comfort in very conservative kind of religion.
So was it the fear in the 1950s of Russia and the Cold War, the beginning of the Red Scare?
Well, the fear of communism broadly.
Fear of communism
speaking,
might have made people kind of pull into themselves mm-hmm. and get more rigid in their thinking. Mm-hmm. What was the Birch, you said? Who were?
The John Birch Society.
The John Birch Society. Could you unpack
that
for us?
This was a, This is loosely put, but it was a 1950s iteration of the Klan, but more global in its orientation, conspiratorialist, but largely born out of the South and the protection of Southern institutions for its white supremacy.
So you're talking about a movement based primarily in a fear reaction then, would you say?
Psychologically, which isn't what I specialize in, I would say that, but they wouldn't say that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also, a friend of mine who writes about this sorts of things talks about it as shame. And I think she's really onto something important there. I don't know that I can play that out for you, but when she does, it connects up. It makes sense to me. There's a kind of deep shame that motivates people who are often engaged in religion like this.
Moving into from the 50s into the 60s, what did it look like in the 60s?
Well, when I say it started in the 50s, it was the very late 50s, like 58, 59. Some of the earliest books came out, and there wasn't any following yet.
Okay.
I think the 60s is when it first really took on some interest, and I think it was the efforts at desegregation.
Reacting to the change of integration. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that the starting of the Christian schools, the segregated schools, and then move us into the 70s. How did it manifest in that era?
Well, it continued in the 70s with concern over, the concern over communism/Marxism always runs through it, even today. I think in the 70s it was the transformation of the roles for women. But anytime there is a cultural change that moves away from social hierarchy, because remember, they're based in pre-Southern Civil War Presbyterianism, which is very much always in history and culture. That form of Presbyterianism is very much imbued with notions of racial, notions of hierarchy that included racial hierarchy, but also gendered hierarchy. And you see that very much in the way that somebody like Pete Hegseth thinks about the world. It's very much a social hierarchy. In fact, these folks are opposed to the idea of equality. We kind of take it for granted, you know? And when I say somebody opposes equality, it sounds almost like that's my characterization of them, but it's not. It's what they say. Sometimes they've even called it heresy because they believe God ordained people to certain stations in life.
So you could say it's kind of a belief in a caste system ordained by God, kind of like the Hindus in India, but in our own culture. So women have a role, men have a role, children have a role. They're taught how to live within their role, and that's the fulfillment of God's will is to stay in your place, basically?
Yes.
Okay.
But this was, I mean, I guess we could look to India for it, but really this was what characterized Christianity in the context of the eras where there was slavery, right? This
right.
idea
and slavery,
of
yeah.
the social hierarchy, you know, all across Europe. People who believed that slavery was acceptable believed it because they believed that God ordained a social hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and moving into the 80s, tell us about that era.
Well, that was really the initial heyday for these folks because they were very much part of the conservative networks in Washington in the Reagan administration. So the Heritage Foundation, this is the organization that put out Project 2025. Their first Project 2025 was Project 1979, right? So they've been doing that a long time. This was the most elaborate and complete, but there was a whole organizational structure of these sorts of groups in Washington, and it included versions of conservative Christianity that were different from these folks. So say Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority, other groups, there were Jewish groups, other religious groups brought together, but underneath. And I never want to make the argument that these folks that I study are responsible for all of this. They're not. They're one of many forces that lent themselves to the growing of this movement. So in the 80s, they were very much engaged in Washington-based political organizing.
Okay, so they got more into the public square in the 80s.
Very much, yeah.
And then tell us into the 90s, how did that keep growing?
Well, just continuing to build. And I think the Christian schools and the Christian homeschool movement are really important. when I was doing research for the book, I went to some of the Christian homeschool conventions, and the Christian Reconstructionist ideas about things so infused all of the curriculum, even in places that wouldn't have recognized it as such. So for example, this guy Rushduni was one of those people responsible for the publication of the book, The Genesis Flood, that launched the creationist movement in this era. Mm. And you know, there are creationist Christians all over Jacksonville. And if you mentioned Rushduni's name, they won't know it. But we rarely know the people who shaped our way of thinking. We often know of a handful of people, but a lot of people shaped how we see the world without us remembering or having known who they are. And I think Rushduni's work was influential in that sort of way.
So you could say in many ways there's an evolution of thinking here influenced by people, just like our bodies evolve, our minds evolve as well.
Yep.
And we would hope that through prayer and contemplation we might have an inspiration, and certainly some people have been inspired. But in general, you could say we influence each other's thinking all the time, don't we?
Do.
And we
yes.
don't really realize that. That's very profound. Contributing to this in the 90s and then moving into the 2000s, as the internet is on the rise, do you think that some of those advances as well play into this fear factor?
This is especially important now because, as I mentioned, this organization in Idaho is what I call the 21st century iteration of this. But the leader of that, Doug Wilson, is, in his 60s?
Uh-huh.
And so behind him is a group of upcoming men that we call Theo Bros, mostly related to podcasts and online kinds of stuff. They're often pastors of a congregation somewhere, but they are known because of the online work that they do. And they have taken a lot of this theology, but they really come down on the gender-related stuff. That's why we call them Theo Bros. Joel Webbin is one of them, if you ever want to Google somebody and find this. But they are very firm in their beliefs about submission and patriarchy. These are people that when I was writing my book, you would hear whispers. They would say in private sometimes, when they didn't know that I had access to that, that they didn't think that women should have the right to vote. But now they say this out loud on the internet. This is a growing concern, I think. People have always dismissed the work that I do as alarmist, way back, you know, in the 80s even. But it hasn't turned out to be alarmist in the sense that it should be dismissed. And I think that the growing attacks on women's rights is one of those things. It seems preposterous at this point. But whether they could successfully overturn the 19th Amendment or not, I'm not sure. But they often chip away at the women's right to vote or at the civil rights movement. Like, for example, they didn't end the Voting Rights Act. They just took little pieces of it out that made it useful. Mm. And I can see that starting to happen with attitudes about women voting.
So given all this push in a way back in history, back to a more hierarchical, judgmental era, what are we to do? What could we do as people who believe in a loving Jesus who was celebrating all people and who listened to women and loved women? How do we interact with these folks? What would be your advice for us if we were to have a conversation with someone who was
Never have a good answer to this question.
You don't have a good answer.
I never have a good answer. At some level, I'm not sure that a conversation with these people is of any value. I don't think you'll change their minds. I suppose, since I do argue that there are people in the world who have been tremendously shaped by them without realizing it, those are probably the people who are more likely to be persuaded by a different view. The core group that I write about, they love to debate. They invite people to debate all the time as though that, to me that's sort of a game, right? You can win a debate, lose a debate. It doesn't necessarily have much to do whether you're right, but they think it does. And so they can be very argumentative and aggressive. You were asking what drew people to this. And in some sense, I think it's also a temperamental thing. Because you have the same thing in, I don't know if any of you read the books by the groups that were called the New Atheists, right? That you have the same sort of aggressive, argumentative way of engaging the world. Mm-hmm. And I think you find a lot of that here. So I don't think that you would successfully...
So the extremists, no, but perhaps people who have been drawn in, who may not have thoroughly considered or thought through this, they might be fertile ground for us to influence. Okay. The establishment of the Episcopal Church was very different, and we sort of associate ourselves with religious freedom because some of our founders were writers of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Are you familiar a little bit with our beginnings?
Yeah.
And what do you think that, how do you think we could somehow become more of a voice in the public square?
Well, Episcopalians have always been a voice in the public square, right?
That's true.
There's been more
Episcopalian... Our presiding bishop says we punch above our weight, which I like.
Like, there's been more Episcopal...
Oh, could you hold it closer?
Yes, I'm sorry. There have been more Episcopal presidents than any other denomination, right? So they've always held a voice in the public square. I think at so many points, I think one of the things that we struggle with as a culture now is that at so many points, the divisions are kind of set in stone. So I think that's true of this discussion about the origins of the U.S. and whether or not we're a Christian nation and all of that. In some ways, we are a Christian nation. You know, the people who founded the country were Christians. They weren't Christians who would be recognized as such by the people who are trying to make that argument. They would say they're not Christians, right? There are different understandings of the people who founded the country, and certainly people wanting religious freedom were one of those. Those people burned witches, so they were inconsistent in their understandings, as people are, in their understandings of religious freedom. And there were certain, you know, like the Pilgrims, the Puritans were kind of theocratic. So I think the real history is much more complex and blended than the mythic histories that we embody and live with.
And that is one of the important things about this day and age, is that we are being asked to tolerate complexity. And for many people, complexity causes anxiety. And so they don't want complexity. They want rigid rules and rigid roles. So change is hard. Complexity is hard.
I was a little nervous explaining the complexity and the question about religious freedom for that very reason. I'm like...
Yeah, no, we understand that Christians...
Am I going to offend people? But.
That we understand that the Episcopalians who were part of the founding of the country were also killing Native Americans and owned slaves. We get that, right? But we're able to hold that in humility.
Well, they're people, just like we are.
Right, yeah. Right. But for some people, it's very difficult to think of their religious leaders as being flawed human beings. So, what hope is there for peacemakers? You said we could influence those who perhaps haven't thought it through. That's one way we could be peacemakers. How else could we be peacemakers given this landscape that has been evolving and been present really since the 1950s here in this country?
From what I understand of people who come out of very demanding religions, whether it's a version of Christianity or whether it's, I don't know, Scientology or whatever, is that people often live in really insular circles and they're all alike, and they talk about people who are outside their circles, but they don't necessarily interact with people outside their circles. And so when people are confronted with the reality that the rest of us out in the world aren't as they were told, that often has a really profound impact. I have a lot of younger internet-based friends who are what they call themselves ex-evangelicals.
Ex-evangelicals.
Instead of evangelicals, they are ex-evangelicals. Some of them are still Christian. They've left evangelicalism, at least. Some of them are not Christian anymore.
Got it.
Some of them are Wiccans. They're all over the place. And many of them tell the story that way. They were raised in a very conservative church. They were homeschooled, and they only had friends who were part of their church community. And they were told that we're all evil, and that we are, all of the characteristics of the left, whatever that is. But then they get out in the world and they meet people who aren't that way.
So one thing we could do is just to try to know them as people and mm-hmm. let them know us as people.
Exactly.
Our story, our personal story, so that their world could open a bit more.
Right. I mean, we know this to be true from other kinds of divisions, right? One of the reasons that, okay, so for example, the organization that most readily embraced racial integration in the U.S. was the Army. And you would think of the Army as being rigid, maybe, but because people from all over of different races and different backgrounds ended up going through boot camp together, they knew each other and their attitudes were changed because the cartoon that had been presented to white people about black people wasn't true. And when they knew black people, then it changed. And I think the same thing,
That's very profound. So just try to be with them. Just try to walk beside them. Just try to know them as human beings. Maybe don't even try to argue with them.
No. I don't think arguing works.
Know them as and love them as a human being. Mm-hmm. That is our greatest hope. I like that very much. Let's give her a round of applause.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for joining me in this podcast. May God bless you and keep you always.